awake after the fire adventure of last night. What I'm going to be talking about is an extension of what I said last time, and in fact, among the first few slides, there'll be some repetition from what I said last time. And let me tell you in advance what it is that I propose to do. To begin with, I'll try and sketch, or re-sketch if you wish, the problem that confronted evolutionary biology in the time of Darwin and the immediate post-Darwin years. I will also try and tell you a little bit about the kinds of solutions which were proposed to these problems, primarily by Darwin but also by others later. So this will be in brief. And then I'll tell you a bit about the system that I'm going to be dealing with here, the cellular slime molds, and simply present certain phenomena before you. So I'm not going to in any way try to make a case that this system follows certain laws or certain rules which verify a particular theory of social behavior, of the evolution of social behavior, and perhaps refute some other theory. I'm not going to be doing anything of that kind. So I'll just present the facts in front of you. And at the end, I will try and point out to you that these things may be interpreted in a certain light, but again, I repeat, that's not going to be a solution. So I'll essentially leave you with very many more questions than answers. So this is by way of warning. What I'd like to try and get across to you is a little flavor of the complexities of the real situation and to think of how you might approach them. And the second thing to bear in mind is what I'm going to present is my view. I will mention very briefly in between of another strongly held view, and the way things turn out, we don't know. Both views may be right, one may be right, the other may be wrong, but that's something that you have to decide for yourself. So this is the system as it looks in the lab. This is a photo by Natasha Matre. They look like a small forest. This is a particular species, in fact, one of the two species that I'll be dealing with at some length during this talk. This is called Ichthyostelium discoideum. And those of you who have seen fungal fruiting bodies will see that there's a superficial resemblance between these and fungal fruiting bodies. There's a stalk and there's a ball of spores on the top. For yeast people here, the spore mass consists of a huge number of spores. The number is under your control in the lab. It could be anywhere from a few tens, actually, to hundreds of thousands. So the size range, or range in terms of number of cells, is absolutely huge. The stalk that you see in this picture is also cellular, and of course you see neither kind of cell. Right. Very quick run through the life cycle of this organism, and right. So we begin with there. That's a picture that you've already seen. It's called the fruiting body, and people who saw it first thought it was a fungal fruiting body and called it that. And from the ball of spores on the top, what you can get.
Peter, can you somehow give an idea of this, the length scales
I'm about to do that. Let me first describe what happens. So from the ball of spores on the top, you can get these individual spores that you see. From each individual spore, maybe I shouldn't touch this at all. So you can see the letters. From each individual spore, you get an amoeba coming out. So you have a bunch of amoebae. Their number is exactly equal to the number of spores that you have on the top. These amoebae feed and divide by mitosis as long as food is available. So starting from a small number of amoebae, you get 2 to the n times that number of amoebae after n divisions. And this can carry on in principle indefinitely. In the lab, of course, you can keep them as long as you wish by serial transfer if you have food around. The food usually is bacteria, but I'm happy to see that they all say that they also eat yeasts. So they're powerful, more powerful than yeast, something for the yeast people to think of. After that is over, after food supply is exhausted, which happens presumably naturally in the wild, and in the lab, it's induced by us because we can watch the bacteria away, something very interesting happens, which is that these amoebae, which until now led a completely solitary life, and in fact there's some evidence that not only are they solitary, but that they actively avoid each other. There's some evidence for a mechanism of repulsion between, for a phenomenon of repulsion between amoebae. They enter into a social phase, and this social phase takes on, is manifested in many ways. The most direct way is that these amoebae come together, aggregate, and you see these pictures of aggregation in G and F. The aggregate piles on top of each other to form a ball of cells, and this number, as I've already told you, can go anywhere up to a few hundred thousand, many hundred thousand. That ball of cells in turn falls down simply because of gravitational instability, gives you this worm-like thing that you see in G. This is a migratory structure called a slug, and that spontaneously erects itself to give rise to H and then back again to the fruiting body in A. So this is what is called the asexual life cycle of the organism. Now a little bit about time and distance scales. In the lab, this takes about 24 hours, or can take about 24 hours, with the proviso that the spore mass, the fruiting body stage, can remain there indefinitely, as long as it doesn't rot, you might say. So you must keep that in mind. The second thing is the size scales. Each spore is something like a few microns, perhaps 10 microns, 10 micrometers in length. So each amoeba is about 10 micrometers in diameter. And that thing called the slug that you see there, so the worm-like thing in G, is perhaps a millimeter in size. And its speed of movement, you've already heard from K, can be a few millimeters per hour, that kind of thing. So a few lengths per hour. Some slugs can go very fast. And there's a second point to be made here, namely that this slug is a migratory structure and in principle can migrate for very long periods. So there again, you have some flexibility in the time process. This entire cycle that I've shown you, or life cycle that I've shown you, is an asexual life cycle. It's the one that we like to study in the lab, and it's the one that I will be concerned with entirely in the rest of this talk. However, it's important to remember that in addition to this asexual life cycle, there's a sexual life cycle involving a zygote, which in this case is called a macrocyst. And we study that in the lab as well. In fact, we made use of it in a specific case that I'll mention to you later. That's a different species, that's a sister species, Giganteum. And we use Giganteum instead of Discoideum because it's easier to take it through the sexual cycle. Those who are microbiologists and those who work with fungi know how notoriously difficult it is to induce crosses and to get the progeny out of the haploid progeny out of the crosses in many fungi. This is just to tell you that the slug and the fruiting body have a certain relationship with each other. So the slug is that structure to the left, the fruiting body is that structure to the right. Remember, I told you that the fruiting body consisted of a ball of spores on top of a row, or a column rather, of dead cells. Now it turns out that the fate of cells is foretold in the slug. So if you look at the slug carefully, and that's what the color shading is supposed to show, roughly the back of the slug is going to give rise to this ball of spores, and roughly the front of the slug is going to give rise to this column of dead cells. This is the kind of thing which is done routinely, or was done routinely long ago by embryologists. It's called a fate map. So what you see there before you is a fate map of the slug, telling you what the fate of each of these cells in the slug is going to be. In addition, there are some symbols there which I'm not going to bother to explain. What the symbols stand for is the fact that specific genes are active in specific regions of the slug. So you can also work out now a genetic map within the slug, a map of gene expression in the slug. And what's rather interesting is that the classical fate map, which distinguishes between cells which die and cells which survive, is rather different from the genetic fate map. So for example, even within the group of cells which are fated to die, there are different genes expressed in different spatial locations. So to put it in simple words, there are many different routes to death in this organism, which is an interesting point that I will not touch on any further. I will just direct your attention to the fruiting body once again. There's some exaggeration for the sake of clarity. You notice that on top of the ball of spores, there's something like a folded sheet of cells. And on the bottom of the ball of spores, there's a second sheet of cells. These are called cups because of their shape, the upper cup and the lower cup. It turns out that these are cells that cradle the spore mass as it goes up. And they themselves, however, do not form spores, but form part of the dead stalk eventually. But these are things that cradle the mass. Right. So much for the system that we are going to be working with. Now we move back. This is a slide that you've seen earlier. These cellular slime molds constitute a group of cells, a cohesive entity in some sense. And as we saw last time, the defining elements of this entity are, and we'll look at some of these things later once again, the units of which it's made are non-autonomous, so each member of this group in some sense knows and responds to other members. There are strong interactions. I won't go into this now, but you heard a little bit about this last time. So the group is more than the sum of its parts. The behavior is cohesive, meaning that there are certain features exhibited by the group, if you wish, adaptations exhibited by the group, which are not visible, and in some cases cannot be visible in single cells. Then there is inhomogeneity, meaning there's structure within the group, what in biology we call division of labor. And finally, of course, there are emergent properties which you begin to appreciate only when the group emerges, when the group comes into place. We've seen this last time. This we've seen last time too. Why is it that biologists are so concerned with trying to understand the evolution of group behavior when it concerns cooperative groups? There are two reasons. One of those reasons has to do with the origin of cooperative behavior, the evolutionary origin of cooperative behavior. The other has to do with the evolutionary maintenance of cooperative behavior. And both of these, as we saw last time, are basic questions. The origin question has to do with, well, as it says, what were the steps that led to this coming into place. The maintenance question has to do with the stability of the situation that you are in. And you must keep in mind that whatever the intentions of the experimenter, most of the time, what you do in the lab, for obvious reasons that I don't have to spell, most of the time, what you do in the lab tests hypotheses for the maintenance of social behavior, because that's a situation that you're beginning with. Please keep that in mind. Right. Darwin, of course, was confronted by this dilemma. We saw this last time. What is interesting is that he came up with solutions that appear remarkably prescient, in the sense that these are solutions that people started wrestling with once again, beginning from the 1920s all the way up to the very present day. And I present these, I show these to you in the form of somewhat extensive quotations, not simply to pay homage to Darwin or to say that Darwin could do no wrong and so forth, which of course would be absurd, but to point out what a careful thinker he was, and to point out that even to this day, it pays to read his writings and to read them with great care and attention. So what were the solutions that Darwin proposed? These are culled from his, from two of his books, and you see the references below. The first solution he offers, so the problem is before you, first solution he offers is that natural selection need not be restricted to the individual, that it can be applied to the family as well, what he calls the family, and he gives this beautiful homely example to drive home the point, to get home the point. He says, a well-flavored vegetable is cooked. And of course, when you eat the vegetable, the seeds in it are gone. So the aubergines that you eat here have zero fitness because you've eaten them. And he says, and the individual is destroyed, but the horticulturist sows seeds of the same stock and confidently expects to get nearly the same variety. So what Darwin is saying here, quite obviously, and I don't think we need to read too much into his words, what he's saying here is what we would today call the principle of genetic relatedness, by which it's not necessary that natural selection is carried out on the physical body of the individual, but it needs to be carried out on the physical body of individuals who share by common descent traits with the individual that you are interested in, this aubergine whose taste you are interested in, for example. This in rather modified form is known as kin selection today. We'll come to that in a while. Darwin's second solution, which is also very interesting, is expressed in the following words. He says, I believe that natural selection, by acting on the fertile parents, could form a species. Here you can use the word species rather loosely, understand the word rather loosely. I believe that natural selection, by acting on the fertile parents, could form a species which would regularly produce neuters. So what he is addressing himself to here is the social insect, so for example ants, in which except for the queen who is a reproductive, all the other workers who maintain the hive are non-reproductive. In fact, many of them are constitutively sterile in the advanced ant species. So they can't reproduce at all. And here, of course, you have an extreme example of cooperation. very similar to the death of the stalk cells that you saw earlier. So here is a bunch of individuals that seem to be acting for the good of the whole, in this case for the good of the whole nest, but with a guarantee that they will never be able to reproduce. So here you have a trait which, if it has arisen by natural selection, which of course is Darwin's working hypothesis, presents you with a huge paradox, because the trait can never be transmitted. The individuals who carry the trait die. But Darwin says here, perhaps a useful analogy to what is happening in these cases in the social insects is, let's say, the animal body, the metazoan body, the multicellular body. Because here, what the natural selection that is acting on is acting on the entire individual phenotype, which consists both of germ cells and soma. So the somatic cells also evolve in response to whatever the forces of natural selection are, whatever the demands of the environment, so to speak, are. But the soma cannot reproduce. So in a sense, the somatic cells are surrogates of the germline cells. And Darwin says here that in a similar way, this entire group of workers who never reproduce could be surrogates for the male parent and the female queen who do reproduce. Was there something, Asya?
I was just
impressed. Darwin's third solution, by the way, so this second solution, goes under the name of parental manipulation in certain contexts. I won't go into details here, but essentially it's the germline soma analogy in multicellular development. Darwin's third solution is very interesting. And here he tries to come to grips with social behavior and cooperative behavior in human beings, especially self-sacrificing behavior in human beings. And this is in his second famous book, The Descent of Man. And here he says, so the question he's trying to ask now is, and someone raised this earlier in this meeting, why do people sacrifice themselves in war, for example, in trying to defend their country or their group or whatever it is. And here he speaks of tribes which fight with each other, and members of the tribe go to fight, knowing that there's a reasonable chance of their not coming back alive. He says, if one tribe included a great number of courageous, sympathetic and faithful members, so these are the people who are really working for the good of the tribe, who are always ready to warn each other of danger, to aid and defend each other, this tribe would succeed better and conquer the other. Please chew over the words. Then he says, we can see how useful their production may have been to a social community of insects. I'm pulling these quotes from two different places, obviously. So it's the same kind of people he's talking about, except these people are insects here. We can see how useful their production may have been to a social community of insects on the same principle that division of labor is useful to civilized man. So, really there's a lot of juice, I might say, in these two quotations. Essentially what Darwin is trying to say here is that there may be traits which are individually harmful and therefore selected against at the individual level, but beneficial to the group, and in spite of this counter-selection at the level of the individual, they may in some way be sustained because of selection acting at the level of the group. Okay? This, of course, now come into vogue later on as group selection, and especially as group selection which is subject to destabilization by individual selection but is nonetheless able to maintain itself. This part I'm going to go through very rapidly. The early post-Darwin years saw a pretty uncritical adoption of the notion that natural selection could act on groups. Therefore, any trait which was present in individuals which was for the good of the group of which these individuals were a part, any such trait would automatically be selected for. People didn't really work out the complexities inherent in selection at the individual acting against the individual and selection at the group level perhaps benefiting the individual indirectly. So this was taken more or less uncritically, and the colony level selection or group level selection was taken for granted, and the names there are of distinguished writers who went into this. The serious phase of thought into this problem came with the people whose photographs you saw earlier in Pat Bateson's talk, I think, if I'm right, or perhaps in Ellen's talk, which is three of the four founders of modern theoretical evolutionary biology. And the four founders were Haldane, Fisher, Wright, and Chetverikov. So far, I've been unable to see anything in the writings of Chetverikov which touch on this problem, but that may be because of my ignorance. But all three of the others, Haldane, Fisher, and Wright, came to grips with this and saw that there was a basic difficulty in reconciling selection at the level of the group and selection at the level of the individual, especially if, as it appears plausible, selection at the level of the individual must be stronger than selection at the level of the group. And let me spell out very briefly why it must be stronger. First of all, the individual is the unit of reproduction, so it's very difficult to think of groups replacing themselves. Secondly, the time scale over which selection can act on individuals is much shorter than the time scale in which it can act on groups. Therefore, there are two ways in which selection on the individual can be strong. Okay. So there's Haldane's famous quote there. Haldane, in fact, provided two possible solutions to this conundrum. And typically of Haldane, the first solution was thrown away in the form of this popular quote, which he never bothered to flesh out later. So he says, I would lay down my life for two brothers or eight cousins, or, I mean, you can go on, two to the 2n is the formula used here. And the argument here is the following. What Haldane is saying is that he shares 50% of his genes with his brother, with his full brother. Therefore, in some sense, the fitness that accrues to his full brother as a result of natural selection could be thought of as equivalent to the fitness that accrues to him personally as a result of natural selection acting on the brother, if you devalue the fitness by a factor of half. And why do you devalue it by half? Because there's only a 50% chance that the brother's genes are in Haldane. So this is the simple-minded argument. Haldane gave a second solution to this problem of selection, and that's something that we will look at slightly later. I think it's even in the next slide. And you've seen this slide again too. This is this so-called Simpson's paradox. I won't take you through the details of the slide, but the qualitative argument is very simple. The argument is as follows. You have a group, many groups, which consist, each of them, of two kinds of individuals. On the one hand, those individuals who do something for the good of the group, produce maybe a commonly used good for the good of the group, and thereby suffer a loss in fitness. Other individuals who do not produce this thing and therefore simply gain in fitness because of this substance that is made by the first members. So in a crude sense, the first sort of members are acting altruistically, the second sort of individuals are acting non-altruistically or selfishly. So it's fairly clear that within each group, if there's a fitness cost associated with producing this thing, whatever it is, altruists will decrease in frequency. There's no doubt of that at all. However, Haldane pointed out that there were two groups in which the frequency of altruists differed. This is very important. So the groups cannot be identical. In which the frequency of altruists differed. And if the advantage to the group of having altruists was disproportionate to the frequency of altruists, so if you had if the frequency of altruists in the group was 20%, the advantage to the group as a whole, and by advantage of course one means here reproductive advantage, the advantage to the group as a whole was more than double the advantage it got when there were only 10% altruists. Haldane saw that if this could happen, then in the population as a whole, in other words by averaging over the two groups, you could still get the frequency of altruists increasing. This is a rather nice, simple seeming paradox. But the solution of the paradox, very simply, is that the group sizes are different and the frequencies of these altruists are different. And you can work out the consequences for yourself. It's called Simpson's paradox for a different reason. And there's a rather neat experiment done by Chuang et al., a synthetic experiment where they were performing selection, where they showed that this could actually lead to an increase in the frequency of this common good producer in a population, so long as they saw to it that there was enough variation between different groups, so long as they saw it that the population structure was heterogeneous. Right. Now we get close to more modern days. G.C. Williams, whose name you also heard, and Hamilton and Trivers, whose names also you've heard, I think, who pointed out that there are really serious theoretical issues attached to understanding the evolution of cooperative behavior, and these can't be brushed aside in a verbal argument of the kind used by Darwin, nor in the kind of superficial reasoning, superficial meaning, not deeply analytical reasoning of the type used by Haldane, but there were deep issues to be confronted, and this is a case in which mathematical modeling might be of help, because it would make you explicitly lay out the assumptions on which you are basing your arguments, And assumptions essentially involving the relation between genes and traits, or if you wish, the covariance between genes and traits, and the reproductive advantages and disadvantages associated with particular traits. So these things were laid down in a set of mathematical models by three of the four people there, namely by Hamilton, by Trivers, not so mathematical, but by others based on Trivers' ideas, and by John Maynard Smith. And the two sort of distinct lines of thinking that emerged from these analyses are associated with the names of Hamilton and Trivers. And these lines of thinking respectively were, from Hamilton, that you could get selection for altruists, in the sense in which I use the word, by extending one of Haldane's two arguments, and that is an argument which has also been made by Fisher, namely by extending Haldane's argument to take into account the possibility that in several groups you have close relatives, therefore you automatically have a chance of fulfilling something like Haldane's requirement jumped into the river, but then the person you saved carried 50% of your genes. So the flavor of the argument is that. We'll look a little bit more at what Hamilton said. Trivers, on the other hand, pointed out that there was at least one sort of situation in which you could do away entirely with the requirement of having relatives around, or having people who shared genes by common descent with you around, and that was when you had a reciprocal situation, a reciprocal picture, where an altruistic deed that done by you today was reciprocated the next time around by a deed done by someone else, so that this reciprocity system could be stable. Remember, both of these people now are trying to attack the question of whether, if this sort of a situation exists, it can be stable. So we have very subtly moved now from the origin of social behavior to the origin of cooperative behavior to the maintenance of cooperative behavior. And that, by and large, has turned out to be the focus of attention today. Right. This is something which is not unusual, I think, in the physical sciences. In fact, it's been quite common in the history of physics, which is that a great advance in understanding has been made, not so much by a new discovery or a new theory which overthrew an older theory and so on, but by clarifying the issues which were behind existing thinking, and in particular by devising a system of notation which made things stand out clearly. This is familiar to physicists. G.E. Price achieved this, and it was really a tremendous achievement. Though when you look at what Price did, you can always say, oh, this is from there, this is from there, this is from there, and so on. What Price did was essentially to devise a system of account keeping which very clearly separated the advantage to individuals within a group to the advantage of a group because it contains certain individuals. So this is the so-called, some people call it Price's theorem, but it's simply a way of separating fitnesses into two components. I won't take you through the symbolism or mathematics, except to say that the symbol W stands for fitness, the symbol delta Z on the left stands for the change in a trait caused by selection of some kind. So Z is the trait, delta Z is the change in the trait. And all that equation says is that trait can change due to two reasons, and the two reasons are respectively the two terms on the right hand side. The second term on the right hand side and the first term on the right hand side mean different things. The second term on the right hand side is familiar. It says that a trait changes in a population because it changes in some fashion in every group of which the population is composed. But there we know that if it's an altruistic trait, the change within every group is negative. That's the assumption that we've begun with. So the second term on the right hand side has to be negative by definition. Each delta Zi is negative. What Price pointed out, that the first term on the other hand, which measured what statistically is called a covariance between groups, could in fact be positive. And if it was sufficiently positive, it could override the negativity, the negativeness, so to speak, in the second term and give you a total positive result. So Price really clarified issues in a way that really stands out even to this day, and told us what the conditions were under which you could get positive selection acting on a trait that was harmful to the individual but beneficial at some other level to someone else. Question now arises, given all of this, are there ways in which you could get selection acting at the level of the individual alone but manifested through different routes, are there ways in which this could be sufficient to account for altruism? And the argument that I'm going to present before you, and remember I've said that I'm going to do so by simply presenting facts, lead me in the direction of thinking, whether they will lead you in a similar direction, I don't know, but lead me in the direction of thinking that yes, this is possible if this so-called altruism is maintained by recurrent individual variation, so individuals have to vary from each other for selection to act. That variation could be genetic in origin, it could be non-genetic in origin, but it leads to a situation in which phenotypes vary, in which selection can act, and competition between these individuals that constitute the group eventually leads to the final outcome. So we'll see a practical example which, let me repeat, does not prove this contention by no means, but suggests that this may be worth examining. Right. Before that, I'll take 2 minutes to tell you what Hamilton's rule is all about, because that also plays a role in our story. This equation has been flashed before you once before. So this Hamilton's rule of relatedness, which is really putting in symbols of Haldane's statement of willing to give up his life with a 50% probability for a brother and so on and so forth. Hamilton's rule is simply a symbolic representation of that anecdotal verbal statement of Haldane's, and it says that a trait which is individually harmful, and the extent of harm is measured by this so-called cost C, can nonetheless spread. So the trait is harmful to the person who is exhibiting the trait, who is performing the act. It can nonetheless spread if the result of that trait to someone else, some other individual, results in a benefit B, right? So long as the cost C is less than the benefit B times the inverse of the coefficient of relatedness. What does that mean? That means that if an altruistic act is performed towards a brother, if the cost of the act is X, the benefit derived from the act is more than 2x, then you can see that x can be greater than whatever that thing is, that more than 2x is, multiplied by half, because half is the coefficient of relatedness. So there are conditions under which you can mathematize this anecdotal statement of Haldane's. There's a huge boost in the first years after the publication of Hamilton's seminal paper in 1964 to this folk version of kin selection, which is what Hamilton's equation is. And the folk version is simply encompassed in this equation, C over B less than R, or C less than B multiplied by R. When people realized, they had known this all along of course, but they realized that the peculiar system of genetics in one group of social insects, the social Hymenoptera, the ants, the wasps and the honeybees, the peculiar form of genetic relatedness in this group guaranteed that if the queen mated only once, in other words, if the nest was constituted of only one mother and one father, then all the workers in the nest would be related not by the usual factor of 3/4 that any two siblings of the same set of parents are, but by a factor of 3/4. So you had this peculiar situation possible where two sisters were more closely related to each other than a mother to her child, for example. Okay. I mentioned sisters here because all the workers in a colony in this colony are female, and the males in fact are in some sense left outside the picture, and it's the genetics of the male that makes this possible, because the male is haploid and results from an unfertilized egg. Okay, if sisters are more closely related to each other than a mother to a child, then it follows that a worker should be prepared to behave altruistically, enable her mother, the worker's mother, to give her more sisters, because that way she is increasing the copy number of her own genes. And this would be a preferable strategy, everything else being equal, a preferable strategy to this worker having a child of her own, because she would be related to this female child, a daughter of her own, by a factor of half. So this was the simple-minded analysis which made people extremely excited and said, yes, Hamilton's rule applies, or certainly the necessary conditions for it to apply exist. And perhaps this is the explanation not only of the maintenance of social behavior in the Hymenoptera, why these workers keep on working in this way, self-sacrificing themselves in this way, but perhaps also for the origin, because if the haplodiploid genetics was first, that would immediately give you a predisposition for sociality. So at one stroke, this seemed to have solved both the origin problem and the maintenance problem. So that was another thing that gave it weight in the eyes of people. But this simple-minded analysis has gradually fallen apart. I repeat, I'm not saying that Hamilton's ideas have fallen apart or that his proposal doesn't hold water, by no means at all. But this simple-minded idea has fallen apart, and I've given you a whole list of reasons there which you can read off later. The essential finding which broke this up was that queens do not mate with only one male. Therefore, workers in a colony can come from different parents, different male parents. They can belong to different battery lines, as it's called. And the same haplodiploid genetics which showed you that daughters of the same mother and the same father have a coefficient of relationship of 75% shows you that daughters of the same mother but two different fathers have a coefficient of relationship less than half. So once that situation is reached, it's certainly not immediately plausible why a worker would prefer raising someone else's daughter, a half-sister to her perhaps, to having her own daughter. Now there are complexities in this that I won't get into. People have tried to say, no, this worker can still selectively favor her full sisters over half sisters and so on. And these are interesting points that people make, but I will not go into it here. Right. Now I move into the second part of my talk, which has to do with contemporary developments. And contemporary developments, recent developments in this field, have been fueled by two kinds of approaches. One is the possibility of using microorganisms to test some of these ideas, and the reason is obvious. You can do experiments with microorganisms within the lab in a reasonable amount of time, which you can't with many of these other things. And secondly, the possibility of doing synthetic experiments, which is of putting microorganisms together in the way you want, and therefore of testing hypotheses, which is of course very difficult to do even with insects. They may just reject your attempt to put different kinds of things with each other. And here we come back to the cellular slime molds that I talked to you about earlier. Before going into the experiments themselves, I want to tell you of one very, very important fact. And having told you of that fact, I will forget it for the rest of the talk, but you will have to remember it. And the fact is the following. There's an enormous amount of diversity, meaningful diversity, functional diversity, in the behavior of these creatures, in the behavior of these social amoebae, as they are known. And the diversity can be illustrated in two ways. Here are four different patterns of aggregation, patterns of group formation which you find in these species. Remember, I showed you one, but there can be as many as these others, and no doubt many others as well. And the second way in which you see this diversity is that the final structure that I showed you, that fruiting body that I showed you, can also take many forms. And here are different kinds of so-called primitive fruiting bodies which were first identified by Lindsay Olive. I think this picture is copied from Olive's book. And the point being made here is that there are some species in which all of these amoebae get together and no one dies. There are other species in which all of these amoebae get together and no one dies, but the ones that survive and form this ball of spores release some sticky substance which acts as a stalk. So it's something that they release. It's an extracellular stalk. Right? This is worth keeping in mind. So the stalk may be dead, may not be dead. Meaning may consist of dead cells, may not consist of dead cells. The stalk may be cellular, may not be cellular. So both of these things are worth keeping in mind. So I'm going to ignore these complexities, which are very real issues, of course, in an attempt to understand altruism, and try to focus on this so-called paradigmatic form, which is the one that I showed you earlier. So the experiments which I'm going to describe to you were done on synthetic isolates, on natural isolates, which were begun in our lab by Sonia Kaushik and later followed up by Santosh, who is here. And the basic isolation method consists of taking a speck of soil, undisturbed forest soil, or animal dung, which turns out to be a rich source of slime molds, and simply keeping it like that. Of course, you can't keep it in the forest and sit there with your microscope because there are, tigers and leopards and other friendly creatures going around. So you bring the soil to the lab and keep it there. So you put it on a piece of agar and keep it there. And what you see after some time, after some days, is that from this speck of soil or from this dung, a fruiting body emerges. Very, very commonly. So you see four such pictures with different kinds of fruiting bodies emerging. Then what you do is to pick out the spores from this fruiting body, study them, one of the ways that I'm going to tell you about. So these are the working material with which you begin. You can already see four different species in these four isolates, and what's of interest in slide D, I think, that's right, that's D, is that from the same speck, by the way, when I say speck, it's a loose term, so this is probably about 100 microns in size, maybe a millimeter in size, but no bigger. From the same speck, you have what are quite clearly two different kinds of slime molds. One of them is pigmented, the other is not, and in fact these turn out to be different species as well. So this is something to keep in mind. They're in very intimate association with each other, even as species in the soil. And Santosh has isolated many forms which, you know, based on our lab experience, we can only call bizarre. One of them is certainly a new species. The thing you see in bee is a new species, where these things get together, and having aggregated, the slug migrates aerially. That's not new. Many slugs migrate aerially, but then bifurcates into two. Now, again, question, why it does that, what the selective advantages might be, if any, and so forth, aren't explored by us at all. So, a number of things of this kind. Right. This is a slide which is not very easy to read, but I'll tell you what its upshot is. So Santosh got these spores, you know, from these fruiting bodies which were grown under quasi-wild conditions, if you wish, raised under quasi-wild conditions, and then simply genotyped these spores. There are many methods of doing that. He has used microsatellites, but this is a simpler, poor man's way of doing this, which is to do RAPDs, what is called rapid amplification of polymorphic DNA. So you use a random primer. Random amplification of the part of polymorphic DNA. So you use random primers and you get a DNA fingerprint essentially of these. And the upshot of this entire slide is that with two exceptions which are in bold and have something in red there if you can see it, the majority of the isolates that we have made, and I think the numbers work out to 14 out of 16 that we have made, consists of social groups, namely fruiting bodies, in which there is more than one genotype present. So these are polyclonal, or genetically highly heterogeneous. Please remember this is a sampling procedure, so even in the case where we got only one, you notice that the two ones correspond to situations where four spores were sampled in one case and just five were sampled in another case. So quite obviously, this is a lower limit that we are talking about, and it's plausible that even in those cases you had polyclonality. It's just that we found only one clone. So keep this in mind, genetically highly heterogeneous. Okay, very quick question now. Why do these amoebae get together at all? This is the basic question you need to ask. Many answers possible. One simple answer is the lifetime of an amoeba by itself, a single amoeba by itself, is rather short. And here you can see viability curves for three different amoebae of three different species. And 50% viability is reached by about 4 days or 5 days or thereabouts. And it declines very rapidly thereafter. So after about a couple of weeks, you stop seeing any further colonies on your plates. Presumably those cells are dead, or at least we think they are dead. They might have been doing something else, of course, but they are not reproducing when you give them bacteria. On the other hand, the lifetime of a spore is very large, and here there is essentially no change in the viability of spore over a period of a month. Of course, if you keep them in the fridge and keep them in glycerol and so forth, they can survive for years, but this is just keeping them in the lab under conditions which we think mimic natural conditions. So one very simple reason for coming together is that if you can come together and form a spore, then you achieve certainly an enormous increase in longevity. Right. Now there are three themes that I wish to present to you, and these are catchwords or code words in terms of which we look at the outcomes of these experiments. So the first theme is non-autonomy, by which I mean very simply that there are quite obviously traits exhibited by these amoebae which indicate that the behavior of one set of amoebae is influenced by another set within the same group. So it's this sense in which we use the word non-autonomy. And these experiments on non-autonomy have been done with the first species that we worked with, Discoidium, and the reason for doing that was because its molecular biology is reasonably well understood and we can play certain tricks with that. Very famous experiment in the history of these cellular slime molds, and this was illustrated to you earlier in cartoon form, which indicates what I think, Aisha, I'm not sure, called scale invariance. So, which means to say that you can take a slug, you know that you have this front versus back pattern in the slug, I showed you the fate map, you can chop up the slug into bits, in fact you can chop it up into many bits. Draper in this experiment, as I remember, used 4 bits in one case, I've just shown you 2 bits here. Each of those bits reorganizes into a front and a back, and in each case the front gives you future dead cells, the back gives you future spores. So this is a dramatic example of non-autonomy, because there are cells in the front which do what they do because of the contextual situation in which they find themselves, and if you change that contextual situation, they do something else. So clearly, this is not an irrevocable fate that awaits them, but rather a fate in a certain context. This is a rather nice experiment that Namita Mazumdar did. This has to do with why the tariq. I'm sorry, no, I didn't get that. Can you repeat that?
If the length of the stalk matters, if you cut it, and if a new fruiting body will be formed, you said, you know, the front end would give you a fruiting body in the back.
Yes.
So if the length of the stalk matters in the whole thing, that...
Okay, maybe I didn't...
Length of the slug, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, well, apparently not. Though very long slugs are dynamically unstable. That is a fact. If you get very huge slugs for one reason or another, you can see them breaking up quite often. But here what is happening is a proportioning of the number of cells that enter the stalk pathway vis-a-vis the number that enter the spore pathway. That proportioning seems to remain more or less constant irrespective of the total number involved. So the relative sizes remain more or less constant irrespective of the total number involved. That's the observation.
I'm just wondering, what determines this fate map? You showed specific genes.
Quite right. So I won't even get into that. That's an extremely interesting question. I'll show you one way in which the origin of cell differences might come about, right? Quite obviously, detailed intercellular interactions are required for setting up of the fate map, indeed. Right, so Namita's experiment was addressed to asking the question of what makes this ball of spores rise up. You remember, I've pointed out already that this is a self-organized process. Well, she was able to show that a hunch, a conjecture of John Sternfeld's turned out to be right. This bunch of spores is cradled by two cells. Remember, I called them the upper cup and the lower cup. And Sternfeld had already shown that the lower cup seemed to have only a mechanical role. In other words, it supported the ball of spores rather than pushing them up. And if you remove the lower cup, you had a risk that the entire ball slid down. What Namita managed to show was that the second part of Sternfeld's conjecture, that the upper cup actively lifted up this ball, was true. So in fact, what is happening in the rising of the spore mass is that there's a bunch of cells sitting on top of the spore mass, which are going to die now, of course, or die eventually, form part of the stalk, which stick to the mass and lift it up. The lower cup cradles this all the time while this is being lifted up. She did this by clever transplantation experiments that I won't go into, using a mutant called Trishanku, where the lifting is aberrant. So you see that in the second picture and the fourth picture. Trishanku spores remain in the middle. And Namita was able to show briefly that if you took a wild-type upper cup, which is done in this experiment, Trishanku spores too could rise to the top. So there's something rather nice here which shows non-autonomy in a rather direct.
So just point of clarification. So lower cup all sits is to support it, upper cup pulls it out.
Well, in the zeroth approximation, I mean, there may be more complications. The lower cup may also be moving up a bit and so on. But this is something that you can show. This is something else. I simply brought this up here because there was some talk of histone deacetylases earlier. Ruthwick, whose name you heard in a different context before, did this rather nice experiment. So this is a histone deacetylase mutant, which presumably is deficient in all kinds of chromatin remodeling phenomena. But on the face of it, the mutant behaves exactly like the wild type. There's no way you can distinguish between it. And without going through details, these are all the bars that you see on the left side of the graph. But the moment you mix the mutant with the wild type, you can see that it's sick. It's not as good as the wild type is at sporulating. Its fitness is definitely significantly lower than that of the wild type. So this aspect of the mutant phenotype, which makes it behave in some sense less efficiently than the wild type, this aspect comes up only when you put it with the wild type. Of course, in a way you might say, look, fitness is a relative concept after all. So unless you have genetic differences, you won't see them. But the point I'm trying to get across here is that these differences are also manifest in genetically homogeneous groups. Here you have genetically heterogeneous groups to bring them out and to show you that these are in fact phenotypically heterogeneous tissue. Right. So non-autonomy was the first theme. The second theme, I must apologize here, I can't think of a better word. If someone comes up later and tells me that this is a better word, a better phrase to use, I'll use it. For the moment, I simply call it non-linearity, in the same spirit that you call non-linearity everything that you don't understand. You say, look, this must be non-linear. So it's in that simple-minded way that I've called it non-linear. Okay, why do we come up with this word? Many reasons. slightly complicated table here, but the message is very simple. This involves an experiment in which two different genotypes were mixed, and now we have switched or jumped species. These are Dictyostelium giganteum. These experiments were done by Bandhana Katoch. And what she did was to mix two strains. They have odd names, and I just apologize for them, there's a reason. 46A3 and 46C6. So these are the names of these two guys, which were isolated in very close proximity in the jungle, in the soil. And they have been put together here. By genotyping, we know, by fingerprinting, we know they're genetically distinct. They're not the same thing. Okay, what happens now? When you mix them 50-50, your null hypothesis, if I might say so, is that 50% of each of these will contribute to the spore, and of course 50% the remaining, whatever the appropriate thing is, will contribute to the stock. By the way, I say 50% here, because here again there's an example of a numerical value which has entered popular thinking, which is misplaced. You quite often hear that 80% of a Dictyostelium aggregate forms spores and 20% forms stalks. This is true in Dictyostelium discoideum, not necessarily true in all other species at all. So these proportions vary enormously from species to species. Here it is 50-50. Now notice, what you get here are different fruiting bodies, and Bandhana was able to analyze them carefully. This is painful work essentially, where she counted each fruiting body, looked at each fruiting body cell by cell, so spore cell by spore cell and stalk cell by stalk cell, and tried to see whether in fact the null hypothesis was satisfied, and whether it was satisfied both in spore and in stalk. Let's see what is interesting. Ignore the first line, look at the second line first. And what the second line says is that in 33 of the fruiting bodies she looked at, the total number is about 50, in 33 of those 50, C6, so I remove the 46 here, 46 C6 is its full name, if you wish, C6 is its given name, 46 is the surname. Okay. So C6 forms more spores than A3, right? So the spore mass has more of C6 than A3, and the stalks correspondingly have less of C6 than A3. So this is rather interesting. It appears that there's some kind of complementarity. C6 is shoving A3 aside, I use this very loosely of course, and making it form stalk, whereas it's gaining an advantage in forming spores. That is 33 out of 50. But the full picture is somewhat more complicated. In 12 cases out of those 50, C6 indeed formed more spores than A3, but also formed more stalk than A3. So it wasn't a simple, I'll do this, you do that kind of thing. Okay. There were no cases in which C6 was in a minority, both in the spore and in the stalk. However, there were 5 cases in which the picture was upside down. A3 formed more spores than C6, therefore appeared to be gaining an advantage over C6, and C6 formed fewer stalk cells than A3. So you see, the picture is rather complex, is all that I want to say. It's not a simple case. A simple-minded interpretation of the fact that C6 forms more spores than A3 would tell you C6 is behaving like an altruist within, like a selfish individual within quotation marks. A3 is behaving like an altruist, again using the word within quotation marks. But the actual picture is not always that. There's an enormous variation in the outcome, and what the reflection of this variation is for selection we will look at later. Aisha, you wanted to say something?
Well, I was just trying to picture how those 4 points would look on a graph, and it looks like they fall on a Poisson distribution. That's just, if you had not 50 but 500,
sure, sure.
Lots of them, that's, yeah.
Sure. All I'm trying to say is that there's no rigid determinism involved here where C6 is pushing A3 down. Completely. These are statistical variations.
Yeah.
No question about it. Right. Something else now, which is a number of mixtures. You see the two familiar names now, and some other funny names, MC11 and so forth, MC10, MC1 and so on. MC is a code for macrocyst. So what are these? Are sexual progeny of C6 and A3. Sexual progeny. Why did we work with sexual progeny? Because if you have sexual progeny, haploid progeny of two parents, you know immediately that the relationship of either parent to either of these progeny is 50% genetically, right? And the relationship of either of these sibs, if you wish, to each other is also 50% genetically. So here we had a handle where we had what we think are unrelated parents and then sibs. Okay, what are the percentages there? These are population-wide numbers, so not individual fruiting bodies analyzed in the way you saw earlier. And what they show, the first part of course reinforces the point that was made earlier, when you mix C6 with A3, the overwhelming number of spores that are formed belong to C6. In fact, 71% versus 29. So C6 is really throttling A3 in this case. When you mix A3 with MC11, which is one of its own sons or daughters, whichever way you like to look at it, you get an asymmetry 57 to 43%, and C6 with the same daughter, again you get an asymmetry 56 to 44. So you get these kinds of pictures which don't indicate any obvious correlation of closeness of genetic relationship with a propensity towards altruism. So for example, if you want to look at best, look at the last line there, which is mixing MC11 with MC1, and you have an enormous asymmetry, 72% to 28%. Okay. So a simple-minded picture which tells that you get qualitative differences depending on whether you are in groups of relatives or not, that doesn't seem to hold. That's only message that I want to get across here. Something else now. Bandhana went ahead. Sonia started this and Bandhana went ahead to try and ask, look, all of these are mixtures of two species, strains at a time, two genotypes at a time. In nature, we've already seen there are perhaps up to a dozen genotypes in a fruiting body. Technically, it's rather difficult to mix many genotypes, and the difficulty is not in mixing, but in labeling carefully and reliably and counting the outcome. We've gone up to three with some confidence, and our current experiments involve mixing four different genotypes. When you mix three of them at one time, here is the outcome that you get. Look at the sides of the triangle. C6 mixed with D2 gives you an asymmetry 57 to 43. This simply means 57% of the spores are C6, 43% are D2. C6 with A3 gives you an even stronger asymmetry, 76%, 24%. D2 with A3, again strong asymmetry, 71% and 29%. These are all mixes in pairs. But when you mix all three together in a 1:1:1 ratio, the percentages are 35, 33, and 31, which are within our statistical errors about 1:1:1. So the three-body system, if you wish, behaves radically differently from what you would predict from the two-body experiments done one by one. I won't take you through this slide. I'll just ask you to look at the numbers. Again, the same result, except that the final outcome is not quite as 1:1:1. You can see that 27%, 33%, and about 40%. But nonetheless, the gross asymmetries there are when you mix them two by two seem to be certainly alleviated to a large extent when you have three. And we will find out now what happens when we have four and so forth. We still don't know.
In order to compare the mixing of two to the mixing of three, shouldn't you use a ratio of mixing of one third to third?
Yes, which is what we have also done, and we get the same thing. So the biases are removed. So then you come back to the null hypothesis. Right, again, this is something which has to be repeated some more times, but the same kind of outcome. And you see, it's not 1:1:1 finally. You again get something like 28%, 29%, 44%. But the asymmetries are stark in the two-way mixes, and they go down. Okay. I won't take you through this slide. This simply makes the point that in many of these experiments, including mixing experiments, there are certain group traits which do not seem to vary. What are the group traits that do not vary? One of them is the overall productivity of the group. And the second thing is this thing called territory size, which came up during some talk, I don't know, perhaps Sylvia's talk. That doesn't seem to vary. There are minor differences from place to place. So this is the size which a group marks out for itself. The numbers don't vary much. So that was the second thing. I talked about non-autonomy, then non-linearity, which is the word that I use. Now I come to trade-offs, and what are trade-offs? Again, pairwise experiments that we do, and I illustrate just one pair for you here. A3 and D2 with the same surname, if you wish, of 46. Right, what happens here? Here, you can see that A3 has a doubling time of about 3.5 hours, 3.4 hours. D2 has a doubling time of about 4 hours. A3 doubles much more rapidly than D2, so clear Darwinian fitness advantage there. Santosh has worked out a protocol in which he can measure these doubling times even when the two are mixed. So he uses a barrier separation with the extracellular material being freely exchangeable, and shows that this difference still persists. So in a crude sense, you could describe this by saying, I don't know whether we've used that symbol here, A3 greater than D2, greater than standing for doubles faster, has a higher fitness. If you let them develop independently, and you have to look at the first row, then the second row, then the third row, the times at which these photographs were taken are shown at the bottom, you can also see that A3 develops faster than D2. So A3 goes through its developmental cycle faster, And you can see an interesting interaction here, which is that when you mix the two together, D2, which is the slower member of the pair, is accelerated by A3. So there's some way in which D2 benefits by being associated with A3, assuming always that it's advantageous to aggregate fast and form a fruiting body fast when you are starved.
Well, they run out of food faster then.
No, the experiments are done by starving them of food at T0, which is the same time, and then following the tempo of development, the time course of development, and A3 is faster than D2, and D2 gets accelerated when mixed with A3. However, when you mix them, and this is mixing at different ratios, you will see why we use these different ratios in a moment, when Santosh mixes them and looks at their efficiencies in spore formation, the picture is reversed. So I have to tell you a little bit about what this picture says. The x-axis tells you the D2 component in the mix. The mix is as amoebae. So you take D2 amoebae and A3 amoebae and mix them together. So the percentage of D2 amoebae varies from 0 to 100. 0 of course means that the whole population is A3. 100 means that the whole population is D2. There are no A3. The y-axis tells you how many spores you got out of this mix that were of A3 and D2. And the straight line that you say, see there, simply says you must get as many spores out as you had amoebae, or proportionately as many spores out as you had amoebae, therefore you get a straight line there. The dotted line, on the other hand, is the experimental outcome. And you can see that D2 does consistently better than A3 here. So this is a rather interesting example. A3's advantage in growth and rapid development seems to be traded off against D2's advantage in spore formation. So this is the sense in which I use the word trade-off. So there are many components to fitness, and in respect of some fitness traits, one does better than the other. In respect of other fitness traits, the other does better than the first. There's a whole lot of other traits that Santosh has measured, including migration, movement through the soil and so forth, which I won't go into, but we see the same picture of trade-offs. Here's something rather interesting. These are guys with two other names, F5 and F16, where not only do you have trade-offs, but you get frequency dependence. The curves are the same. So the x-axis is the percentage of F16 amoebae. The y-axis is the percentage of F16 spores. The continuous line is the null hypothesis. The dotted line is the actual outcome. And here, of course, we have to be a bit careful because of the funny shape of that line. To be careful to repeat experiments many times, get our statistics right and so forth. What you get here is what is called frequency-dependent selection. Namely, whether F5 does better than F16 or F16 does better than F5 depends on the relative frequency. And I will direct your attention to two points. One is that the dotted line cuts the straight line in two places. And the second point is that the first of those two places where it cuts the line indicates stable equilibrium. Why does it indicate stable equilibrium? Because if you are a little bit to the left of that line, F6 has an advantage over F16 has an advantage over F5 in spore formation. If you are a little bit to the right of that point, F16 has a disadvantage relative to F5 in spore formation. So you see, that's a point of stable equilibrium. In addition, you have a second point, which is clearly a point of unstable equilibrium. So if the frequency of F16 rises beyond the second point, it goes to fixation. So here you have something rather interesting happening. The possibility of coexistence plus the possibility of one of them wiping out the other. Obviously, we have no idea at all what happens in nature, but this is what we see in the lab. Yes, Aisha.
In the previous slide, I was wondering how you drew the dotted line. Not this one, but the previous one. Because I was thinking it could also be that dotted line could be drawn in a way that again, intersected the diagonal in a similar fashion.
No, okay. Here I can
only
see.
How do you really draw?
Oh.
Because up there you have a point where your point falls right on the diagonal and it goes over and under and over again.
No, it doesn't, because we've looked at intermediate points. There are two points there, if you see. I agree. Technically, you cannot rule out the possibility that between two very close points, you have other points which cut the curve. So we've gone as close as we can. If you look at this curve carefully, the last two points are indistinguishable from the null hypothesis. The last two points.
Yeah.
Okay? But all the others are statistically significantly above the null hypothesis.
How do you value your error bars?
How do you?
Are they one standard deviation?
Yes. Yeah. The error bars are just one standard deviation. Yes. Just for representation. So that's mean plus or minus one standard deviation.
But if you look in between those two last points, maybe you could find
No, I can't rule that out at all. I can't. So you never know in fitting a number of points to a smooth curve. These, by the way, were fitted to polynomials. This is just because we wanted to see where we would get the best fit. So this was also done to a polynomial. As you can see here, you need a cubic, and here a quadratic will do. You never know in curve fitting whether between two points which you have experimented with, there are other points which are going crazily up and down.
But you can do one more experiment.
Which is? In between. Yeah, yeah. Those we have done. But how far do you go? Someone will come tomorrow and say, do one more in between. So that's a point I can't answer at all. What you say is true, but I think it's unlikely. Okay, so this is the other kind of thing that you get. Again, you know, indicates what I said earlier, kind of trade-off of different kind. Good. So I will end now with the trying to say that what I think underlies this whole business, and maybe a useful framework within which to understand this whole business, is to say that you have a number of amoebae which are starved, and in the natural situation they seem to belong to many different genotypes. But once they are starved, some kind of internal mechanism within them that we can speculate on leads them, first of all, and I'm making this point, I'm asserting this point without demonstrating it, leads them first of all to develop a tendency to adopt one of two fates, and the two fates I will say very simply, describe very simply as remaining alive or dying. Many internal heterogeneities which can bias these possibilities, and the simplest you can think of is nutritional levels. So you can see that in a bunch of amoebae, better fed ones on average have a better chance of surviving than poorly fed ones. So that's one variable you can see. We have looked at other variables in the lab. Calcium is an example. So this is a bunch of genetically uniform amoebae raised in the same environment, and using a calcium sensitive probe, Shweta was able to show that these amoebae actually consisted of two different phenotypes. That's the dotted line in the main picture where she has a clear bimodal distribution of calcium. So you have high calcium cells and low calcium cells within the same apparently homogeneous population. And now when you mix them, you can show that the high calcium cells preferentially go to the front of slugs, the low calcium cells preferentially go to the back of slugs. So in some sense, between these two bunches, the high calcium cells are more likely to die and the low calcium cells are more likely to survive. Please remember, this is a relative property. This is not an absolute property. So tells you immediately that in addition to those heterogeneities which you saw, which were indicators, there must be strong cell-cell interactions going on which stabilize those heterogeneities.
So, is there any reason why the high calcium ones are grouped together? They are not spread all over the slug?
Exactly. So this is the point. So all of them sort out, and the mechanisms probably are similar to the ones that Kay was talking about there, where you get sorting out spontaneously due to differential motility. And we've been able to show recently, thanks to Gopal, Gopal probably showed that in a slide, that these cells also have different motility properties. So we think it's a dynamical consequence of motility differences. Okay, I will ignore the bacillus, and this is a nice example which I've just present. So this is a bunch of pancreatic acinar cells. This is done by Hardiker in the lab. These are clonal populations, so these are tissue culture cells of the type that Anu exposed you to yesterday. A clonal population grows, so the single cell becomes many cells. And it turns out that in this clonal population, some cells express something called FGF, which you see there, fibroblast growth factor, that is red in this picture. Other cells express the receptor of this fibroblast growth factor, which is green in this picture. The ones that express FGF do not express a receptor. The ones that express a receptor do not express FGF. And what is interesting here is that FGF turns out to be a chemoattractant, a chemical attractant. And therefore these cells get together and form an aggregate. Not like dictyostelium does, but nonetheless they come and form an aggregate. And this is of interest here for the person doing the experiment, because this aggregate is like a prototype tissue. And he has gone some way already in showing that you can get a differentiation of specialized cells here. In his case, cells that make insulin, you know, the beta islet cells. But that's not our interest. Our interest is in saying that from what appeared to be a homogeneous population kept in the same medium, you got a spontaneous heterogeneity, which was later manifested in various things. Good, so I ignore that too. You know, this phenomenon of things happening, meaning, heterogeneity is appearing along with division of labor is known in a completely different context which is not much looked at. This is the context of chimeras in developmental biology. What are chimeras? Chimeras are animals which are created artificially. In the plant world, of course, this is very familiar. Animals which are created artificially by fusing embryonic cells of two different origins. Now, the name of Beatrice Mintz and the Mintz-Hilmenz experiments was mentioned, where you had different kinds of, I believe there were mouse chimeras or perhaps rat chimeras, I've forgotten. These are chimeras, pardon?
No.
Mouse chimeras. These are chimeras here, formed between cells from animals which belong to two totally different sheep species, goat and sheep, which evolutionarily are believed to be have diverged 13 million years ago or so. And what you get finally in these things is not a very healthy looking creature. It was christened the Jeep, so hybrid name. But it's there. So all I'm trying to say is that these cells, these embryonic cells, clearly are able to talk to each other. Clearly they have the kinds of signals that they can to some extent share with each other. And by self-organization can build a mass. In spite of genetic relatedness, quite obviously, certainly not kinship by descent, quite obviously not being a factor in deciding that they work together as a coordinate group. This comes from a series of famous experiments by Nicole Durand, again chimeras. In this case, these are chimeras of the chick and the quail, and she used this as many of you will know in her studies of neurogenesis. And in fact, others followed it up with trying to see the development of bird song. Again, the dark region here consists of cells from the quail. The lighter regions are from the chick. Now, what you call this creature is up to you, but there you are. Okay. So in the case of Dictyostelium, what we think is happening, maybe I remove that slide, what we think is happening, or what I think is happening, okay, not we, is that you have an amoeba which is starved, and in some sense it flips a switch. Now, what sense does it flip a switch? I don't know. Could be in one of the senses that have been discussed in this meeting, and gives rise either to a pre-spore cell or to a pre-stalk cell. What does pre-spore mean? It means presumptive spore, something which everything else being equal would become. Pre-stalk similarly means presumptive stalk. So that's a simple-minded model which you have in A, and you will notice immediately that if these probabilities of switching are complementary, so that one plus the other adds up to one, then you get a constant ratio of the two types. So there's no interaction between these two cell types at all. Now, you can get more complicated formals, you can build more complicated formal models of this kind. In B, for example, you have the same thing as A, except you say that these probabilities are sensitive to the total size of the group, so you've brought in some signal. In C, you say everything that you had in A operates, everything that you had in B operates. In addition, these two cell types can revert one to the other. So a pre-spore cell can become a pre-stalk cell and vice versa, which of course experimentally you know is true. D takes into account the fact that that is a slightly simple-minded view of the picture. C is a simple-minded view of the picture because these cells are in fact not interconverting all the time. In fact, they're stable as cells are. So you put in negative feedbacks. And one way of analyzing this simple model, and I must tell you it's really almost a cartoon way of analyzing this model, is to take small groups of cells, very small groups of cells. This is an advantage you have in this system. You can work with a few tens of cells and up to 100 cells or more and count things singly. And now count very carefully what the mean value of the pre-spore fraction and the pre-stalk fraction is, or of the spore fraction and the stalk fraction is, which is what we did, and also measure fluctuations against the mean. And the point of measuring fluctuations is that you can get the same mean answer in A, B, C, and D, whatever those percentages were, 80% and 20% or 50 and 50. You cooked it up, of course, so no wonder you get it. But the fluctuations may not conform to that number, and the fluctuations may enable you to discriminate between these models. So when we did that, Ashok Bhogle and I did that, indeed we found this was the case. The actual data are in D. What you see in A is the simple Poisson model that you would get. Each point here that you see is a single experiment, and what you see on the x-axis is the total number of cells that you counted in the fruiting body, which were there, and in this graph they vary from about 20 to 120, and what you see on the y-axis is the percentage of spores that you got. So you can get this kind of fluctuation in real life, and that is shown, as I said, again in D, And you can show that the simple Poisson system has too much noise, if you wish, too many fluctuations. Poisson system plus size sensing also gives you too much fluctuations. But if you put in size sensing and feedback, you seem to come close to something which is happening. So clearly the real picture is a complex interplay of internal tendencies, spontaneous, what we call coin tossing here, or spontaneous stochasticity, combined with intercellular interactions. And what may be happening in the group as a whole is that following all of these things, each cell essentially is taking a bet when it comes together with other cells. And the bet, of course, is that it's going to form a spore. Quite often it loses the bet, but it may make up for this loss in two ways. One, by being in some other group in which it does form a spore, but doesn't form a stalk. And secondly, by within the same group, trading off with other cells in different fitness-related traits. So, if this picture is true, then you have a rather complex view of what underlies the maintenance of cooperative behavior in this organism. And that complex view is brought about by an interplay of internal heterogeneities, phenotypic heterogeneities, and intercellular interactions involving trade-offs. Thank you. Mike, please.
I'll
repeat your question.
Now, speaking of your multiple species, as you might of this evolutionary dynamics in one of the lizard species that has a rock, paper, scissors sort of dynamic system.
Thanks.
I was thinking that one possibility would be that if you have multiple species and the fact that there are little differences might imply that this is your
very
thing, rock, paper, scissors.
Very true, very true. Except that it doesn't seem to happen here. What Mohinesh is asking is, there is a situation studied involving, they are not lizard species, there are three different phenotypes in a lizard species, where it turns out that if you have A with B, A does better than B. If you have B with C, B does better than C. And if you have C with A, C does better than A. So I go back to Jacques and René Thomas, you can see immediately that this gives you a kind of oscillatory equilibrium, if one can use the word. And Mohinesh is asking, does that apply here? In principle, of course it could. But in all the studies we've carried out so far, we have found strict transitivity. So whenever A does better than B and B does better than C, we find invariably within things that we've seen that A does better than C.
Oh, sorry, that was not the point. The point was that there are different combinations, right? So a single...
Oh, I'm sorry, I'll reword your question. Now I understand what he said. So he's saying, it may be that the outcome in an AB combination, an outcome in a BC combination, and an outcome in a CA combination may in fact reward these three differentially to permit stability in the population. Absolutely right. This is the sort of thing that I have in mind as trade-offs. Yes. Yes. Yeah, there was a question from somebody here. Tariq.
So, where you were mixing A and B, and you showed that A is dividing rapidly, mitotic,
yes, A divided more rapidly than
B. More rapidly than the B, but the B sporulation is
more efficient. Yes, yes.
So if I try to oversimplify, can I explain in evolutionary terms that B feels that it has a disadvantage because it cannot vegetatively divide? So it immediately enters into sporulation. That's why you have more of the spores because it wants to have next generation.
No, that it doesn't do. See, in that particular case that I showed you, A divided more rapidly than B. I'm calling them A and B for simplicity, please. X and Y, if you wish. X divided more rapidly than Y. X also developed more rapidly than Y. So the among the two of them, the one that moves ahead first to sporulate is also the one that divides faster. But later, in sporulating in a mix, Y does better than X. Chuck.
This model, because Stellium was in the textbook of social biology, was presented at, during the 90s, was presented as the model of kin selection, because the story was that the homogeneous bodies, the bodies, were more efficient, well, better formed and so on, and so that the individuals would sacrifice themselves in history, written exactly like individuals sacrifice identify themselves they would more tendency to sacrifice themselves for their brothers than for their cousins. And it is very interesting your work that shows that in nature, most of the clones are polyclonal, because this means that the story that you can build by culturing these stuff in petri dishes and measuring what they do, you will not correspond to nature.
Can I respond to that point? So, I think one must keep in mind that the question is, simple-minded models of kin selection depend on your working in either genetically homogeneous groups or in groups that involve genetically very closely related individuals. Here, on the other hand, we've shown polyclonality. Right? Therefore, Jacques says, what you usually study in the lab, which you do with clonal groups, of course, for other reasons, which are also good in their own right. So the outcomes that you get from studying clonal populations may not be reflective of what is happening in the wild. True, but I would add this proviso. One has to be very careful, and this is where I'm a bit bothered by extrapolating from a small number of species. This is what we have found in Giganteum and Purpureum, two species. In Dictyostelium discoideum, it turns out that you can get both polyclonal groups and clonal groups. So I think what is happening in the wild, and I think Paul has been drawing attention to dispersal all along as a fact. Depending on how dispersal works, you can get a bunch of spores belonging to different genotypes in one place, in which case later you will end up with polyclonal groups. Or it may be that by accident you have a single spore falling somewhere and giving rise to a colony of amoebae, in which case you will get a clonal group. So it may well be that in nature you can get both clonality and polyclonality. So the only point being made here is that clonality is not necessary to explain the maintenance of this behavior.
So the question I wanted to come to is there has been a trend to explain everything in terms of what the people call the ultimate causes, which means actually to give some theological explanation to what you observe. And I think that in Amoebia it has been shown that the efficiency of forming the fruit body and so on depends on transmembrane protein, contact proteins and so on. So would it not be much simpler to explain everything that you observe in terms of the proximal fruit?
One would want to, yes, of course. So the question here was, won't you sort of eventually perhaps want to give a mechanistic explanation of what you are seeing? Absolutely.
Just follow on Jacques' question. You show that when you isolate a slime, a fruiting body from the wild, you have phenotypic genotypic diversity. My question was, the genotypic diversity inside an isolate, is it smaller than the genotypic diversity at wild? I mean, is the null model enough to explain you have some genotype that spread over the whole space, and then you group them into different slime modes, or do they associate closer than that?
Okay, the short answer is I don't know, because our sampling has been very small. What I think is happening, however, is what I said earlier, which is that you, depending on the mode of dispersal, you have either bunches of spores of different genotypes in one place or single spores in one place, so that you can get both clonality and polyclonality. So once you have some idea of the population distribution of different genotypes, the densities, then you can create the null model and see whether it agrees with this or not. I really don't know. Sylvia.
It seems to me that all you described, and also something that other people described in the course of this workshop, fits very well with a sort of mechanical model, where you would have that cells that starve, they move faster. When they enter into slugs, they are those that basically stay in front of the slug, and then they end up in the stalk. Which would mean, from the point of view of modeling, of an evolutionary biology modeling, that maybe cells that end up in the stalk would not do it to make a spore. So you would have like an additional cost to this that is not usually accounted for in the simplistic models one uses for the study of cooperation, of the evolution of cooperation. And a second point
can I respond to that? Okay, the two responses I want to make. One is to remember that it's not immediately obvious whether any advantage might be gained by a cell in going to the head of the slug, in the front of the slug. People believed for a while that this might be a way of improving your chances of getting food. Remember, all of these are starved. Now, there the experimental situation is a bit complicated. It turns out that in many cases, if you present these slugs with bacteria, they just go through them. Apparently, they've lost all interest in food and just want to grow. So that's one point. The second point is you must remember that we are speaking of relative differences, not absolute differences. So the cells in the front, which are the ones which are going to form stalk, if they're isolated, right, the majority of them will still form spores.
There are also other mechanisms by which you would conserve this. If you consider the, for instance, AMP oscillations, you could consider that when they are in slug, cells are organized depending on their internal frequency of oscillation that is related to their speed. And if you cut the slug, this organization will be maintained. But the second point I wanted to say is that basically I don't think you really need to hypothesize that from the beginning a cell decides whether it is pre-stalk or pre-spore. This could be also decided much later depending on the spatial organization of the slug,
okay.
I think.
Okay, so here there's an experimental fact that I did not mention for lack of time. The experimental fact is the following. You can take amoebae initially and more or less isolate them. And I must say, what we mean by that is keeping them at a density of maybe 1,000 in every square centimeter, or perhaps up to 10 to the 4 in every square centimeter. And we're reasonably confident that at this distance apart, they cannot signal to each other. Okay, reasonably confident, right? Now, under these conditions, it turns out that you can systematically bias using various environments, systematically bias the probability that a cell forms a stalk or a spore. When I say stalk, obviously I don't mean the full structure of the stalk, it can't, but gives rise to the morphology of a stalk cell, dies and forms a morphology of a stalk cell. The spore you can identify. So what you can show very clearly is that an isolated amoeba, isolated in the sense that I mentioned, actually has a certain probability under defined conditions of forming a stalk cell or a spore cell, and you can bias that probability in interesting ways. That you can show, a cell by itself. What defines it? Well, in the lab, it's in your hands. So, Ellen?
So it helps me to think about these things, to get clear about these things by thinking about them from the point of view of a potential free rider.
Of essentials, you said?
A potential free rider, a cheetah. So thinking
about it. See, I'm a bit uncomfortable. I've already used the word altruist, used the two words altruist and selfish. I'm a bit uncomfortable with these words for the following reason. What you call a cheetah turns out to be so heavily context dependent that it's risky using the word to define a cell or label a cell. That's my difficulty. And especially even more risky to associate it with a genotype, as some people have tried to do. That I think is plain wrong.
Okay, I suppose there's sort of an answer there already. So I was thinking if you were trying to think of ways to cheat, yeah, it strikes me that one problem you're saying there is with trying to design a cheating strategy, one is the trade-offs. There's just kind of no single strategy that can maximise all the necessary components at once. I understand that. I understand a little bit less what the phenotypic heterogeneity is doing. That's kind of a way of saying that you don't know which other strategies you'll be playing against in advance. But that's already is that?
Well, let me just try and restate what I said. Coming back to the word cheater, by the way, I think the word has played a very useful role because it made us aware of the fact that the issue of stability is important. So So people use the word cheater, first said the system can be undermined by cheaters, and that's when people, everyone else started thinking, yes, you may have a system, you may reach a particular endpoint, but is it stable? So I think it served a particular role, I don't deny that at all. But using the word as a label, I think, is wrong. Coming to the second point, phenotypic heterogeneity is a fact. So you can see these cells differ in different respects. And the calcium thing that I showed you showed that they differ in a certain respect even before they come together. You can show this in terms of nutrition, as I said, when you impose the bias yourself. The calcium thing was a spontaneous difference. And then you can show that these differences are correlated with functional differences later. So that's all that I will say. So there are certain differences that you can see at the pre-social stage. Those differences correlate reasonably well, not 100%, correlate reasonably well with post-social behavior. Aisha.
Hello. What happens if you just mix in some amoeba that don't have this fruiting body formation?
Yeah, I'll state your question in a different form and answer it. There are genetic mutants known which don't even aggregate. So I mean, the whole game stops with them. They can feed and eat and divide, but finished. In many of those cases, you can mix them with the wild type and rescue the phenotype. Many cases. But this is not.
I have a question regarding...
Okay.
H-dead mutant. In what proportion do you mix H-dead mutant?
Those were all 1:1. Those were all 1:1.
And what was the interpretation, I
think? No, there's no interpretation at all. In fact, by the way, let me reiterate what Sylvia said, and I think someone else, perhaps Aisha said, we need mechanistic explanation for all of this. And no doubt this is self-organization that you're seeing, underlying. Okay, so right now we have no explanation at all, except that we are saying here that we see something that we can interpret as fitness, but we see it only in the context of a heterogeneous population. It's not apparent when the population is homogeneous, genetically homogeneous. Yeah, someone at the back, I think. Yeah, Shweta. Yeah, she had her hand up. A higher efficiency of spore formation, except when they were there at very high frequencies. Aisha pointed out, there the points seem to fall on the line.
So, did you also see that some of the cells have a reciprocal behavior?
I'm sorry?
Did you also see that some of the cells behaving in a reciprocal way?
What does that mean? Behave in a reciprocal?
Like AP cells getting...
Good point. I can't answer that. See, the problem is the following. In that particular case that I showed you, which was A3 and C6, it was possible to count these cells, stain them and count them carefully. Clearly, this question can be answered. I'm not saying it's impossible. But at the time we did it, we couldn't answer this because there's a strong autofluorescence shown by D2, and we were using fluorescent probes. You follow? So clearly it's doable in other ways. So I can't answer the question now. Maybe that does happen, and I won't be surprised. Shall we?
Given an equal chance to form a polyclonal or a uniclonal protein body, what would the...
Yeah, that's a lovely question. So we've explored that in great depth. And again, the answer is, it depends. Meaning, if you evenly mix two strains, two genotypes, you get a range of outcomes depending on which two you are mixing. Outcome one, you mix them in a 50-50 proportion. All social groups are 50-50, subject, of course, to Poisson fluctuations, which you can't escape, right? Outcome two, much, much broader range, so that you get mixing frequencies ranging from 10% on the left or 20% on the left to 80% on the right. So they do mix, but they also seem to have a self-non-self discrimination. Outcome three, absolute dislike of each other. So even though you mix them in a salt and pepper fashion, they sort out. Please remember, I'm speaking of the same species now. They sort out and you get entirely fewer fruiting bodies. So clearly the experiments we've been doing have been with genotypes which get along with each other.
They sort out and into different tissues? How do they?
Yes, different fruiting bodies. So they're separate physically.
Sorry, I'm pushing on the same point again, annoyingly, but rephrasing it. I guess my question is really, why should we have this phenotypic plasticity? Why shouldn't you get a line emerge that doesn't do that plasticity and only ever forms spores?
Okay. Verbal argument. Why isn't it that having come together, for which you can give plausible reasons, everyone doesn't form a spore? Verbal and not 100% convincing argument, but reasonably plausible. You can imagine that a ball of spores by itself would lie on the ground. And given the alternatives of lying on the ground or lying a huge distance above the ground, like a millimeter, which is gigantic for these creatures, may mean the difference between dispersing and non-dispersing. So if the whole idea of coming together is A, to escape starvation conditions or to withstand starvation conditions, and B, to get away, then you're much better above the ground than on the ground. Because if you're above the ground, you can stick to the leg of a passing insect, you could be eaten by a nematode worm, or that entire area of grass could be cropped by an animal, so you would get churned up in its stomach, but you know, you would get transported to wherever the animal wanted and so forth. So I think there's strong selection pressure for dispersing when you disperse passively. So the assumption, of course, is that this is passive, to stay above the ground. And that if everyone formed spores, that would be a less efficient way of doing it. Now what you could ask is, why doesn't everyone form a spore and form this sticky thing that I told you about, which lifts them above the ground? Here you come into issues that we can barely touch on, because here you have two rival strategies followed by two entirely different species, one in which they do this sort of thing. Everyone forms a spore and then they secrete something, a glue, which enables them to rise above. The other, in which many form spores and many others actually form this rigid stalk. So there the answer is a sort of civil engineering answer, which says that the trade-off is between everyone forming a spore but standing on something which is probably not terribly stable, versus some of them forming spores but standing on something which is really a truss kind of structure. So that's a purely verbal argument. Yeah, last question please, we should break up.
One is, what is the mechanism of selection of altruists among the group from this talk? And the second question is, once they have been selected, how are they starved? Because the food is uniformly available to all the individuals. So what is exactly the mechanism of death in this case?
Well, the first question I've answered here, and it's a rather complex answer, I won't go into it again. The second question, how do they die? What was asked? Okay. Well, I mean, those of you who work on cell biology know that there are, so to speak, many mechanistic ways of cells dying. There's something called apoptosis, there's something called autophagy, right? And of course, there's cannibalism, where you die because someone else wants you to die, you don't die yourself. All three are found in these. Cannibalism rarely, in certain exceptional cases. Turns out you do find autophagy, and you find something like apoptosis in mammalian cells. So there are some features that it shares with them, other features that it does not. So let's break up now. Thanks very much, and we meet in 15 minutes.